Welcome to the Women Who Fights podcast. We empower female fighters to take full agency over their training. Our goal is to celebrate and inspire others with the incredible action women and allies are taking to level the playing field. We talk to experts, uncover prejudice, and champion what's driving our progress.
And today we have Lily with us. Lily's a purple belt and coaches adults and children. She recently graduated with a first in psychology and spent a lot of her degree researching the mental health benefits of BJJ. So thank you for joining us, Lily. Tell us a little bit more about yourself.
So, that's most of me. I'm a purple belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I teach at Rebellion BJJ in Sheffield. And yeah, I teach the kids, the ladies class and mixed classes. I am a trainee psychologist, so I've just finished my doctorate, and I'm just waiting for my accreditation before I can be an actual psychologist. I work at a facility for people with brain injuries, and I've got sort of a special interest in neuropsychology. Wow. And I previously worked with people who had functional neurological disorders, so people who had physical symptoms, but they didn't have a medical cause, they had a psychological root. So I'm really interested in the brain and how that impacts us.
Is that to do with like psychosomatic pain then?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
I had lots of people with kind of different kinds of pain, fatigue, seizures, tremors, all sorts of things that was all down to trauma, really. Yeah, the brain's so powerful, and the mind-body connection is you know, really strong.
What kind of trauma, physical trauma or emotional trauma? Yeah. Sorry, I've just dived down into this. This is fascinating.
That's fine. It really could be either. And for some people, it wasn't always sort of a clear-cut trauma, so it might not have been something like a car accident or abuse. It could have been, you know, all sorts of different things. And some people never even found the root, but it was very clear that something that most people had in common is a struggle to connect with their emotions and allow themselves to feel and express those. And then they can just become bottled up. And when we don't let them out, our body sort of speaks for us and it can come out in physical symptoms.
God, and can this be treated? Can this go away, or do you have it forever?
Yeah, so some people have these symptoms for a long time. Some people have them for a shorter period of time, and lots of things can help with it. Medication, physiotherapy for some people, and talking therapy, and that was my role. So processing that trauma and helping people develop new strategies to deal with the feelings.
Wow, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's sort of like a stereotypical thing that people get like lower back pain or something when they get older, and there's just like the stress, or you get headaches, or, you know, other. What about migraines? Are migraines something which can be psychosomatic?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And we all experience physical symptoms as a result of our mental health to some extent. And the mind-body connection impacts us all, even on a small level. So, you know, we get upset and our body produces tears. We feel nervous and we might start to shake or sweat. And that's sort of the lower end of the spectrum. And then it can go all the way up to people having seizures.
Yeah. Wow. And is that... Sorry.
Go on.
So seizures be sort of like your response to having bottled up emotions, is that so you bottle up emotions because of some kind of trauma, and your reaction to that would depend on your makeup and how you're, or would it depend, do you know what I mean, would it depend on like your, the type of person that you are, or
my view is that it's environment but also genetics that impacts the way that we deal with things. And so yes, for some people it will be a combination of that, and it may be that they've grown up in a household where emotions just weren't acceptable, you know, they weren't allowed to express those, and so when you learn that as a child, then that tends to develop. And we tend to stick with that as an adult, and then it can be really difficult to break that cycle, at which point, you know, when we become overwhelmed and we can't deal with the stress, our body can just step in, shut down, and, you know, we can't deal with it anymore, and that's when a seizure can happen.
Yeah, there's a few books about that, isn't there? There's the When the Body Says No. Is that, and I think Gabor Maté talks a lot about that stuff, the sort of the connection.
The body keeps the score is another really good one.
Yeah. I think I have that, but I haven't read it yet.
Have you worked with athletes before?
No, I haven't. I haven't worked with athletes. I've worked, some of the clients I had were sort of, they were athletes, but not professional athletes, but I haven't worked specifically with athletes. I think that would be really interesting though, and something that, you know, potentially I may look to do in the future.
Because that would be interesting to see if, like, sort of certain injuries were caused by, you know, like you get injured just before a big fight or something, how the connection between your, I don't know, it's almost like protective or self-sabotage in some way, sort of like how your mind can step in.
Yeah, exactly. And the same with illnesses, you know, when our immune system's running low, because we're stressed and overwhelmed, we're more likely to get ill.
Do you look at like the vagus nerve and how that connects your gut and your brain? And because it's, isn't it like your emotions are all over? They're not just, I don't know, they're sort of in your gut as well.
Yes. Yeah. I do. I've worked using that, using theories. The polyvagal theory is a really good one as well. So that's thinking about the mind-body connection again, and it's a different way to address that and help people sort of understand how our emotions and our thoughts can directly impact our physicality.
It feels like a really exciting thing to be looking into, because it doesn't feel like maybe I'm wrong, but it doesn't necessarily feel like it's the most mainstream part of healthcare. Normally you go in with a problem and then they treat the symptom, don't they?
So the service that I worked for previously, there weren't many of them in the country, and actually this one was in Sheffield and it was one of the larger ones. Functional neurological disorders, it's not, most people don't really understand it, they've not heard of it, and I think a lot of us in our everyday life, when we're experiencing illness or fatigue or body aches and pains, it can be really heavily linked to stress and anxiety, and we just don't realize. We just assume that we've, you know, gone too hard at the gym, or we're feeling a bit under the weather, and not necessarily think about how are my emotions right now, how overwhelmed am I, have I got way too much on my plate.
And does it connect to, like, is it also autoimmune diseases that connect to it, so like fibromyalgia and ME? And
I did have some clients with fibromyalgia, and that can absolutely be sort of, talking therapy can be something that helps people who have fibromyalgia.
Wow. Because that's a really, I mean, they're all autoimmune diseases are awful, but fibromyalgia is a scary one. Because it just hurts, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Everything hurts.
All right. That was us diving into a little bit of what you do as part of your work. Let's talk about your training. So you're predominantly training with heavier men, coaching them too. So what are the challenges, if there are any, which I think there are some. So what are the challenges?
Yeah, there's quite a few.
Go on. Go on.
Lots that I've experienced over the years training with men that are just much bigger than me. I think the challenges have changed, definitely, as I've progressed through the belts. So at white belt, I started training at a gym and there were no other women there. I think there might have been one other woman there, but we were never at the same classes because I was at university at the time, so not getting down as often as I wanted to. And I just felt like all of the men avoided me. They didn't want to. I felt like they didn't want to spar with me. I wasn't taken seriously as a role. I was a lot younger then. I'd never touched a weight in my life. Still sort of believing that women can only do cardio. And I don't think I would have stuck with jiu-jitsu if it were not for training with my dad, because he started training before me. I know people sort of speak about getting bitten by the jiu-jitsu bug, and you know, once you start, you're obsessed with it. And that was not the case for me. And I think that that was a lot to do with training with men that were so much bigger than me, that I just didn't feel confident. I didn't feel able to make the techniques work. And I think that started to improve when more women started training at the gym. And my mum started training as well shortly after, about 6 months after I started training. So that changed things. And I think, sort of, as I progressed through the belts, as I got to sort of blue belt, then the challenges changed, and it sort of seemed to be, rather than men avoiding sparring with me, they almost, it felt like they sought me out, like they wanted to, I don't know, beat up a blue belt or something like that, which led to me putting a lot of pressure on myself, wanting to prove that I was worthy of the belt that I had, worthy of the space that I took up in the gym. And I got really frustrated when sparring with the bigger guys and just not being able to make things work, and them just being able to bench press me. It's just, yeah, not a good time. And then I guess as I started coaching, that was sort of towards the end of my blue belt that I started coaching, I started to feel more pressure. So, you know, thinking, why would a guy twice my size want to hear anything that I've got to say or, you know, learn from? Our body types are so different, and we're learning a combat sport, and how could such a small woman be any good at that? These were all thoughts that I were having, and I think that some of the actions of people in the gym made me believe that more. So I felt like people questioned me a lot more, the things that I had to say, more so than the male coaches. People would talk over me. People would sort of say that my success in sparring was because I was wriggly or small. I could get out of submissions because I could wriggle out of them. And it never really felt like it was down to the hard work that I put in. And then I felt like when I raised that, you know, when I tried to say that to people, I just get sort of told that, oh, that's not the case. You're being paranoid. And it was really frustrating. It's not like that now, though. Around that time, a lot of stuff happened with the gym that I trained at, and a head coach left, and then things sort of improved. We decided to run Rebellion as a collective, and now rather than the gym being dictated by someone based on a piece of material around the waist, it's a collective of all the coaches and all the knowledge they have and the differences and the diversity that we all bring. And I think that that's been a massive change, and it's made me feel so much more confident in training with bigger people, in coaching bigger people, because I have the support of the coaches at the gym. And I think, so yeah, that's probably the biggest thing that's helped me with those challenges. But lots of different challenges, and it's changed throughout the belts, I think.
I think it says a lot, though, that, you know, it's a lot to do with your head coach, and they sort of lead by example, don't they? That you, if they're not setting a standard, then people just don't tend to realise that that needs to happen.
Yeah. And it was things like teaching a very heavy pressure game, and that having to be the blanket for everybody. And then anybody teaching something slightly different, that was not okay. That didn't work. But actually, that does work when you have a different body type. And it's things like that were just not accepted. And now they are. And so I feel like it's a much more inclusive space for people of different genders, body types, flexibility, age, all of those things. It just feels like a much more inclusive space.
That's amazing.
Did you have people that, you know, lower belts that were going too hard to make a point of, you know, tapping or, you know, destroying the instructor? And if so, did you ever say anything on that?
So at first, never, no. I'd just get beat up and then still wouldn't feel like I could say no to sparring with them, because I somehow just had to deal with it, because I had to prove that I was worthy of that belt. Whereas now, I would absolutely say something. You know, recently someone had just got the blue belt, they sparred way too hard with me, and I just stopped the roll and I just said, there's no need to go that hard, I'm a lot smaller than you. And they took it really well, and I think that's the thing. It's not always the case that people just want to smash you. Sometimes it is. But sometimes it's people just not having that awareness of their body weight and how much it can impact someone who's smaller. And I think I used to build up in my head so much that it's a really negative thing if I say you've gone too hard, because it means that I can't deal with it. But actually what it's doing is it's making it so that those bigger people can now train with everyone else in the gym better. You know, we have other women in the gym. We have kids that spar in the adults class now because they're sort of in between, you know, that teenager age. And so it's really important that the bigger people and men can spar.
Definitely. With people like that.
But yeah, at first I would have never said anything.
But I think that says a lot. Like, you know, I've definitely had that before where I've rolled. I was the same as a white belt. I would roll with anyone who would want to roll with me because I felt like I had to prove that I deserved to be there. And then when I got higher grades, I think the other day I said to someone, "You're rolling too hard," and he just was like, "Oh my god, I'm so sorry." And we talked about how he couldn't change that, and then he did, and it was a completely different roll. And I was like, "Oh, we can roll again then." Like, I will. I'm not gonna blacklist you. We will do this again.
Very, very, very interesting.
But it's like, you know, often higher grades will be able to roll better with women. And it's that experience, isn't it? It's like they learn, they understand, they learn how to like navigate their body in a sort of a responsible way with someone smaller. And, you know, but I think it's quite rare that you get a white belt who'll not sort of, who will have that kind of awareness, like you said.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's time. And learning how to move your body and understanding the positions and how heavy you can feel in certain positions. And also being able to tolerate a smaller person taking advantage or being better and knowing more than you. That can be a bruise to people's ego, and that can sometimes, you might start as a nice role and then you start to, you know, get into a good position and then suddenly someone's freaking out and they're not okay with that.
And they and you're like,
yeah. Yeah, that can be a learning curve for people, I think. But as a higher grade, you're used to that.
Do you ever say no with a role, or would you tell them, you know, you're going way too hard, fix up? Or would you say blanket no, you know, I'd rather not?
Yeah, I will say no to some people. You know, if I've given people so many chances and I've just been injured and it doesn't seem to be going in, then I'll just say no. Sometimes when people visit the gym, I don't necessarily always spar with them. I'll wait and see how they spar with other people first. I think that's something that I've trained quite a few times at a gym in Spain when I go on holiday to sort of similar place each year. And one of the black belts there, I've seen her just say no just to people that are visiting and just not spar with them. And that made me feel more confident to be able to do the same. Just think, oh wait, hang on a minute, I actually don't have to roll with you if I don't want to. You know, a lot of visitors, they do spar really well, but just sometimes I'll get that feeling and I'll just say no.
Have you ever stopped a roll halfway through?
Yes. That was one of the recent ones. That was more recent. I just said, okay, I'm done, because I'd sort of said maybe twice during the roll, can you calm down a bit, you don't need to go so hard, and they just continued. And so I just said, okay, I'm done. And then I think one of the other coaches ended up having a word with them, and they were fine after that and they understood it more. And I think maybe it was just being in the moment. They were quite young as well, just a lot bigger than me. So yeah, I have said no, and I feel okay about that. And they were apologetic, and I think it's just communication. And sometimes in the moment, people just can't take that in. I don't know if it's because they're so caught up in the role, the adrenaline. But sometimes it's necessary just to stop.
Yeah, definitely.
But also, not everyone will say you know, calm down.
Yeah, exactly.
I know people that would go, oh God, when is this finishing? But they will endure it, and then, you know.
Yeah.
And then
what? And I've been there.
Yeah.
And
me too, 100%.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. And I think that as much as it's, you feel guilty, you don't want to hurt someone's feelings, it's not worth being injured for. I've been injured so many times and had to have time off training because someone's gone too hard. And then I've thought, why didn't I just say something? Because now I'm stuck at home and I've done nothing wrong.
Well, that's it. I mean, you know, what's the point in, it's not your fault if they hurt you, it's their fault. And you're putting your training out on the bench because do you know what I mean? It really doesn't make any sense. I was rolling with someone fairly recently and he got into mountain and he was in my garden. He put all of his weight on my throat and he was this big 100-kilo man. And I just tapped and he was like, what? And I was like, I'm done. Like, get off. What are you doing? And he was really sort of weird, confused. And I was like, what? Can you logically see how this is not an appropriate thing to do?
Yeah.
But I would never have done that before, ever.
No.
I mean, Shanti had her eyes. Closed.
I got kicked in the eyeball by a very tall white belt who was just flailing around, and he felt awful afterwards, obviously, because he didn't mean to do it. But I went like blind for like a couple of hours, and then I had to be taken.
Oh my gosh,
it was horrible. But it was like since then I've just been like, right,
yeah,
nah, we're not doing that. Nah.
Yeah.
But yeah. How do you train around your period then? Is that something that you deal with, like that affects your training?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have endometriosis, so it really impacts me. On a monthly sort of basis. It didn't used to be so bad. I used to get really bad periods and have to take some time off training and didn't understand why. And then obviously, as most people do, go to the doctors, get told it's normal. Years later, you find out it's not. Now I just take the time off when I need it. So around that monthly cycle, if I'm coaching, I'll try and get cover if I need to. If I feel okay, then I'll just sort of spend the time coaching, helping people, and just not sparring and not making myself feel bad for it.
What do you feel when you say they're bad? What are the symptoms? How bad is bad? What do you feel?
It can vary. So it can be anything from stomach cramps to I've collapsed on the floor and I feel like I'm like throwing up. Crying, awful pain. Obviously at that point I don't train. But there doesn't seem at the minute to be too much of a rhyme or reason for it, and it can just happen randomly. Usually it's worse on my period.
Do you feel bad in the lead up, so that in the PMS part of your cycle, or is it just when you start bleeding?
Yeah, it's just when I start bleeding that I feel the most physical pain. But I definitely notice a change to my mood, my fatigue. I think tracking my cycle sort of on an app has been really helpful. And I think that's also helped me with sort of lifting weights as well, because I never realised that as a woman, you shouldn't be comparing your sort of PBs week by week, because it makes such a difference based on the hormones in your body at that time. And you should really be comparing it week by week of your cycle. So the first week by the first week. And that's made a huge difference to my weightlifting, to CrossFit, to training jiu-jitsu, because, you know, I might have a really rough week at training and not do very well, whether I'm not being able to lift the weights I could or just getting beat up by everyone. But then I can sort of, you know, have a look at my app and track that and think, okay, well, I'm going to be more fatigued at this time in the month, and that's okay. Yeah. But without that knowledge, I couldn't understand that before. And again, that just led to so much pressure and expectation that I should be constantly getting better and that I couldn't have.
Did you find that pressure you put on yourself impacted your training in a negative way? As in, like, you know, because it did it tire you out? Because I know that if I put a lot of pressure on myself, I get really tired.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it definitely led to me resenting training at times. You know, there were times where I was sort of forcing myself to be at the gym 5-6 times a week and feeling a lot of guilt or being critical of myself if I had time off, if I took a night off. And it just led me to actually slowing my progression, I think, because I was there physically, but mentally I wasn't making the most of the training and I was just feeling absolutely exhausted. And now I've managed to balance my schedule a bit better to fit in with the days that I commute to work and the days that I work from home. And I train more on the days I work from home because I'll get more sleep the night before. And I've just found it's been amazing for physically recovering in my body, and mentally enjoying training more, getting more out of it.
Definitely. That makes so much sense. And I mean, so you studied BJJ and its mental health benefits. Can we talk a little bit about how you studied it and what you found out?
Yeah. So, as part of my doctorate, I did a thesis and it was sort of 2 years research project. And the purpose of that research was to explore the relationship between positioning in a social network of a Brazilian jiu-jitsu gym and mental health symptomology. It was a 3-part study, and so I was collecting longitudinal data, and I used DAS21, which is sort of a score, a scale to measure anxiety, depression, and stress. And then I created a social network analysis to explore the interactions between the members of the gym so I could establish which members were in the core of the social network and which members were more on the periphery of that, and then sort of analyze that to understand people's mental health, basically. And the results were sort of in line with other research and found what we expected, that people in the core of the social network, so right in the middle, with more social interaction, more connections with people, experienced lower levels of anxiety, depression, and stress. And I think the research was even more interesting for me because it took place over the course of the pandemic. So the first point of data collection was just before COVID, before we sort of realized what was going to happen with the world. And then the second 2 data collection points were during lockdowns, during the pandemic, where, as we all know, gyms closed and then they opened and then they closed and training was just not as it was. And I found that the people in the core of the social network, their mental health got worse. So the anxiety, depression, and stress increased, as did everybody's, so the people on the periphery as well. But the people in the core, even though their stress, anxiety, and depression increased, it still increased less than the people on the periphery. So there was sort of a protective factor there. Obviously, just based on one study, I can't say for certain why that is, but we can sort of see that it's in line with other research, and it seemed that being in the core of the social network, having more connections with people in the gym, was a positive thing for people's mental health, even through a time where people were not able to train as frequently as they normally would.
So it sort of focused on the community aspect of BJJ, not just sort of the idea that you're doing a sport, therefore you have endorphins, therefore you feel good. So it was really focusing on human connection, and that was the benefit.
Yeah. It sort of seemed that that was a bit more of a gap in the research. You know, there is plenty of, well, it's not plenty of research on BJJ, but most of the research on BJJ is looking at the more physical side of things.
Yeah.
So it's looking at the brain chemicals that are released. It's looking at the physical activity. None of it specifically sort of looked at social network analysis to focus on mental health. And so it felt like that was given that it was just a 2-year project, I wasn't able to do it for longer than that. It felt like a really appropriate thing to sort of measure, because when we talk about jiu-jitsu, we think of our BJJ family and the community around the gym, and it feels like a really special thing. And so to me, that's what stood out as something that potentially could be a huge factor in impacting people's mental health.
Sure.
So when you say interactions, social media interactions, do you mean, you know, messaging people, or do you mean, you know, anything that's around commenting, liking, etc.?
Yeah, so it's just any kind of social interaction. It doesn't have to be social media. So, you know.
Oh, sorry. I thought you were talking about social media.
No, just interactions in general. So, you know, who you train with at the gym, who you speak to in the gym, who you spar with, who you got outside of training.
But during the lockdown, how did you measure that?
So part to sort of analyze the social network, I asked a series of questions, just asking who people were still in contact with, and asking who people's training partners with. Obviously, the training partners one was when we were still training. And then also monitoring sort of how frequently people were training, the types of training they were doing. So throughout lockdown, the gym that I coach at, we had online training like a lot of places did. So factoring that in as well, thinking about, you know, are they messaging on a group chat? Are they meeting up outside for a walk? Are the people that are still interacting, even though they can't train together? So it wasn't just about the interaction of literally sparring and training with a person. It was all the interactions that occur as a part of the jiu-jitsu community.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, people get addicted to jiu-jitsu, don't they? It's a sort of a cliche, but it really helps a lot of people. And yeah. I think it is partly because it can change people's fitness and therefore their mental health, just as a knock-on effect of being fitter and sort of maybe, you know, you feel better about your body, you feel more connected to your body. But then it's like the community element. It's like they're two sides of the same coin, really, aren't they? They're as important as each other.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you go.
No, go on.
No, I was just going to say, I agree. I think there's so many reasons that BJJ is so addictive. And like you said, I think obviously you're getting physically fitter and stronger, which is always something that tends to make people feel better about themselves. But you're also learning how to defend yourself, which is really empowering, or it has been for me. And more so than that, you're frequently putting yourself through stress. And when we think about the brain chemistry, that's triggering your fight or flight system. And that's releasing adrenaline and cortisol. And, you know, they're the stress hormones. And when we frequently sort of trigger these hormones, our body becomes so much better at dealing with stress. And so research has actually found that this sort of ability to deal with stress can implicitly transfer to other areas of your life as well. So it means that people that train BJJ on the whole are more cognitively flexible. They're more able to remain calm when making decisions in other areas of their life. And so that's just one aspect of almost the cocktail of neurochemicals BJJ leads to the release of. And I think, you know, that doesn't come often in many other sports. You know, when you put yourself under that level of stress, and you sort of having to deal with that, it's going to transfer to other areas of your life. And that's on top of the sort of learning a new skill. And when we learn a new skill, our brain then releases dopamine, which is a feel-good chemical. And then, like you said, also, we're really close to people. We're making friendships and connections. And that's releasing endorphins and oxytocin. And so when we think about it in that kind of aspect, we can see why it would be so addictive, because all of these chemicals have been released through this one activity. Why would we not want that? So that's going to make us feel good and connected and like we're achieving things.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one thing I found really fascinating that you said, it was like the neurochemistry that's going on with the stress hormone. So how does that work? So because obviously, so you're in a stressful situation repeatedly, So then when you're in a stressful situation, like at work, or something happens, like an accident happens in the street or something, and you're in a stressful situation, what's actually happening in the brain? Is it because you're used to the stress, or is less cortisol or stress hormone being created? Or what's actually happening?
You become so much better at dealing with it. You know, you're used to your body producing those chemicals, putting you in that fight or flight, feeling the physical symptoms that you get as a result of that. So feeling out of breath and sweating and your heart pounding, and you're used to being under that kind of physical stress. And so then when you're in another situation that's making you experience that, it's almost like you're used to it. Right. And although it's not the identical situation, your body and your brain have become accustomed to making decisions under that kind of pressure. I think it's sort of like competitors. The more you compete, the better you get at it, because you're so much better at dealing with that kind of stress and that adrenaline and the way it makes your body feel. And you become much more in touch with your body sensations as well. So you can understand, okay, I'm used to being in stressful situations. I know when I'm stressed that my heart pounds, that I get sweaty palms. And so therefore you can then sort of notice when you're in another stressful situation, right, this is my fight or flight system, this is anxiety, or this is me panicking. Whereas someone who's never in a stressful situation, those sort of sensations in the body might be really alien to them, and dealing with those physical sensations can be incredibly stressful and difficult. Whereas in jiu-jitsu, well, I feel that all the time. you know, when I've got a 100-kilo guy on top of a mount, I'm definitely feeling stressed. And I'm very aware of how my body feels and the reactions that my body has to that. And I'm now much more able to remain calm in stressful situations that are like that. And in other aspects of my life, when I'm getting those same physical sensations, I've become much more able to breathe through it. Just like I would when I'm on the mount, I'm going to slow my breathing. I'm going to focus on the here and now and what I need to do to deal with the situation. And then I feel that helps me apply that in other situations. You know, I'm at work and something stressful is happening, right? I'm going to breathe through it. I'm going to think about the here and now, and I'm going to do what I can in the situation. Yeah. And although it's not the same, it's similar.
Yeah.
And how do you think the series of lockdowns that we had, and hopefully we'll never have again, has impacted martial artists in general? Have you come across any discussions, any study? I mean, studies unlikely, but any discussions around that?
Absolutely. And there is actually some research on it. I know the UK BJJA, they did a study looking at the impact of lockdowns and found that sort of over 80% of the people that were involved in that study who trained BJJ had experienced a negative impact on the mental health. They'd also experienced things like a decrease in fitness, an increase in weight gain, an increase in alcohol consumption, and all that makes sense because I think most of us experienced that. and I think, you know, we've had a huge part of our life taken away from us. It's for a lot of people a coping mechanism. You know, a way that they deal with their daily life stress is to go to the gym at night and beat people up. And when you can't do that anymore, how are you going to deal with your stress if that's all you've got? And
do you think it's because I definitely am among those that, you know, need a coping mechanism. Do you think that it's, if you're needing to train that much, that you'll suffer so much without it, do you think that there's something else there that needs to be dealt with? Alongside the fact that it's community and fitness makes you feel good and all of those other things. If it really, really, really hits you so hard, is there actually possibly something else going on where you're like, maybe I'm just running away from something?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's why, you know, the jiu-jitsu is therapy mantra can be quite dangerous, I think, because, yeah, for a lot of us, it can be therapy, and it was for me for a while. But then, just like you said, when that's taken away from you, how do you deal with the stress in your life if that's the only coping mechanism you have? And suddenly people feel like a huge part of their life and their identity is missing. And Jiu-Jitsu is wonderful and it's mindful and it helps us build up our distress tolerance, but it's not therapy and it's not a replacement for therapy. I think we have to be in touch with our thoughts and our feelings and our body sensations and understand what's going on for us. And just using BJJ as a distraction from all of our problems is never going to fix the root of that. It's just going to mask it. And then eventually we might not have jiu-jitsu anymore to mask it. And that's when the problems are going to arise. And I think I did that for sure, definitely. And then I think my, you know, training in to be a psychologist and going to therapy myself has been so helpful because it's helped me understand a lot about myself, a lot about my thoughts and my feelings. And now I know when, yeah, I need to go beat people up. That's going to make me feel better. And when actually I just need to sit with my feelings and just allow them to be there. And I think if anybody feels when they can't train that a huge part of their life has been ripped away and that they can't then deal with the stress, it's definitely an indicator that they need to spend some time working on themselves, which is hard. But yeah, therapy is always a good place to start.
I really loved what you said there because my next question would be that we see people that have this, they find a sense of belonging in jiu-jitsu and they link it to their identity. So they are this champion of the So when an injury comes, then things become really, really stressful because you're like, well, am I not this person anymore? So is this emotional detachment that needs to happen basically work on yourself and what underlying things are there?
Absolutely, I would say.
Oh.
I'm always going to advocate for therapy because it's my job.
Of course.
But yeah, absolutely. We need to have other things outside of jiu-jitsu. We need to understand ourselves, understand our ways of coping, understand our body sensations, and so we can figure out when we are stressed and when we are overwhelmed. And we need to do that outside of jiu-jitsu. Jiu-jitsu needs to add to our life. It needs to not be the only thing in our life. That's a trap that a lot of us fall into because it's so easy to, because training can make us feel so good. But then just like you said, when we become injured or when something happens, it means we can't train. That's when the problem occurs because we no longer have that coping strategy. We no longer have that part of our identity. And, you know, we can keep in touch with training partners. We can be a part of the group chats and turn up to classes to watch. But I think we all know it's not quite the same as being on the mat. And so, yeah, we need another way to be able to deal with that stress.
I mean, I find that really fascinating. I think, as you say, every life will, to some degree, everyone's experienced that. So the red flags for that sort of thing then are for you basically using jiu-jitsu or any, it could be anything really, but as a coping mechanism would be if you actually cannot live without it and everything goes to pot as soon as you stop, basically.
Yeah. And if you're using it as a way to mask your feelings and escape your feelings in your life and your stress.
How can you be honest with you? I mean, I've had therapy and I've sort of done that and I sit with my emotions. I've been, the process you're talking to is really rings a lot of bells in my head. But if you're not, if you are someone who hasn't experienced, who doesn't, maybe not, is not in touch with their emotions, it's sort of like a catch-22 because you probably don't realize you're not really in touch with your emotions, and then you sitting with them just becomes like this thing of like, oh my god, how do you even do that? Like, how do you even accept that this is a feeling? I don't want to sit with this feeling. It's not a nice feeling. How can you recognize that in yourself if that might not be something you've already recognized?
Yes. I think, you know, if you're finding that when you're overwhelmed and you're stressed, You just can't cope without jiu-jitsu. You have to go to deal with and forget about all of your problems. And if you imagine your life without jiu-jitsu and it is absolutely miserable and there's nothing left and there's no way to deal with the stress, then you know that something should change, really. Because if you were to lose jiu-jitsu, you know, you probably wouldn't want to imagine what your life would be without that. And it is a huge part of all of our lives, obviously. And like I said, I've been there with that. But yeah, it's important that there's other things, there's other coping mechanisms. And I suppose there's a difference between having a stressful day, going to the gym and feeling better, and then having a stressful day and feeling like I absolutely must go to the gym because I can't cope if I don't. Rather than it being, I'm going to go and it's going to make me feel better. I'm going to get to see my friends. I'm going to get to do some exercise. And if you don't go, I suppose the negative of that would be, you know, you feel really self-critical. You feel there's no way to deal with the feelings that you've got. You can't stop thinking about them. You know, these are all red flags that, mm-hmm. that jiu-jitsu is playing possibly maybe too much of an important role in the way that you deal with your stress and anxiety and your mood.
Mm.
But it's hard. It's hard to notice that. And I think it just takes time. And I think I've just been fortunate that in my training, to be a psychologist, I've had to notice my own feelings because there's no way to not. But
yeah, you're right in it.
Yeah, you're right in it. And I think, you know, but if not, then confiding in your friends and talking to them, finding other things that you love and other things that make you feel happy. It's all good places to start.
If you go to the gym, you've had a bad day, you go to the gym to, you know, get this lovely feeling afterwards, and you don't get it, and you're more irritated?
I think we've all been there as well. I definitely have, yeah. You've had a bad day, you want to go to the gym and do well in sparring, and then you get beaten up by absolutely everybody and you feel so much worse than when you went in. And I guess the only way that we can deal with that is by just thinking, yeah, sometimes it is a bit shit. Sometimes that's you know, we can't always win, but okay, you're going to be learning. You're always going to be learning. If you're not winning, then you are learning. And I hate that saying because everybody says it, but it's so true. And I think, again, that's another sort of red flag, is that, you know, if you do have a bad night at training and jiu-jitsu is your only coping strategy, then how do you deal with those feelings?
Mm.
You know, how do you make yourself feel better? Do you have people you can talk to?
It's quite interesting because I feel like the people who do, I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, my people who do let's just say BJJ, but could be martial arts or any kind of sport, are in some way competitive. You know, you've got to have a bit of competition in you to sort of want to win the fight and to do well, which is also, it's sort of like, but then the people who are the hardest on themselves are competitive people. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of like a soup of people who are also competitive with themselves and everyone else. And they're all trying to like, do you know what I mean? So it also, it's like the people who really, really need to sort of not be hard on themselves are all in the same space. I don't know if I'm making any sense. It's just occurred to me that it's like, it's ironic.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. It is. And I think it tends to be those people that are so competitive and are so hard on themselves that they struggle to stick with jiu-jitsu, because it's not, there's no quick wins. You know, you can't get your black belt in a year. I know it's obviously there are struggles with other martial arts, and I can't speak for those because I've never trained another martial art. But yeah, I think the people that can't deal with losing, that are super competitive and super critical of themselves when they lose, are the people that will either quit or they'll have to sort of face that and figure out a way to deal with losing, because it's inevitable, really. And if we're that critical of ourselves when we lose, then we're just going to have a miserable time.
someone said something once to me, which was like, if you're really critical of yourself, like not self-criticism can be really positive, right? It can be good to sort of check yourself and see how you can improve on stuff. But the concept was like, imagine, you know, you're whipping yourself all the time. Like, you're sort of putting yourself down. You're always sort of like making yourself feel like crap. Imagine how much better you would do if you stopped like whipping yourself.
Yeah.
And it sort of, it really, I was like, oh, that makes so much sense.
There's one more thing I've heard this last week. Someone came to talk to my students and they said that to them and it clicked. So they said, when you're having a bad day or you did something that you didn't like, and you think about it, right? And you self criticize and you're like, oh my God, you're shit. Why did you do that? Think about it the other way and think about it as if you're talking to a friend. If they were, you know, really bad on a day, you wouldn't go to them and say, oh my God, I saw you sparring, you're so shit. You're not going to do that. You're not. Why are you telling that to yourself? And it just clicked. It was like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If someone had a bad day at training, you would not turn and say to them, you know, what was that? You would go like, oh, maybe work on this, maybe work on that, more generally.
Yeah. I mean, and I've heard like the reverse. I've heard the reverse when it's like people are really hard on themselves because they're worried that they won't actually do anything unless they are hard on themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Self-criticism can have so many purposes for it. And it can be for sort of self-correction and checking yourself, making sure that you don't get lazy and you don't do things wrong. And so it can have a function to a certain extent, but it can be really dangerous because I think what a lot of us don't realise is when we are critical of ourselves, it has the same impact on our brain and our body as when someone else is critical towards us. So if someone were to come and tell you that you were shit, it's the same when you tell yourself you're shit. You know, your body reacts in the same way, your brain reacts in the same way. And I think that's really powerful because the amount of times a day we might be critical towards ourselves, if other people were being that critical towards us, we would think, this is just not okay. I need to step away from this person. They're making me feel terrible. But we don't think, wait a minute, I'm doing this to myself. I'm making myself feel terrible. I don't deserve this. And I think that was a big thing for me, is understanding that when I'm critical towards myself, that has the same impact on my body as when someone is towards me. And I don't want to do that to myself. It's not fair.
No, I didn't know it had the same impact.
To stop and to change that behavior, but it's really good to have that awareness at least, because then we start to notice more when we are being critical of ourselves. And when we notice it, then we're then much more able to start changing that and to be more compassionate.
Yeah, self-compassion, it's the way.
Absolutely.
Easier said than done. In your studies to do with mental health, have you seen a difference between men and women within BJJ?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. I think there's so many differences between men and women in BJJ in life. And I think, you know, in jiu-jitsu, I can only really speak for women because obviously that's my experience. And I know that there will be a lot of struggles for men in jiu-jitsu. But I think what I can say is that as a woman in jiu-jitsu, it feels like such a fight to be taken seriously sometimes. It feels like your opinion isn't as important. And I've had plenty of experiences before where, you know, one example, I would be explaining something to a student and then they would question me. And then a male coach would come and just say the exact same thing I said. And then, fine, yep, I understand it. Great, I'm not going to question you. And I'm just like, you just said exactly what I just said. Why is this suddenly not an issue anymore? And I think things like that, that's a huge difference between women and men. I don't think that, you know, I'm quite close to the coaches at the gym and they don't get questioned half as much as I do. They're just believed. They can say anything and people would just be like, yes, that is true. I'm going to do it exactly this way. and then I say it, and I've got 10 questions as to why I'm telling them to do it this way, or, you know, why I'm explaining it. And that's just one small example that is frustrating.
That sounds very frustrating.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of, well, I suppose an example of coaching and the differences between men and women, and I suppose there's lots of positives as well. But yeah, that's sort of the coaching side. But were you asking about the mental health side? Yeah. So I think with society, there are big differences in women and men. I think there's still a massive stigma around mental health as a whole anyway. And I think for men, it can be even more difficult to open up and speak about feelings. And I think that's why, again, BJJ can be such an amazing thing to do, because the community that it creates can be a really safe space for people to start opening up and talking about their mental health and their feelings. And with it being often such a male dominated space, it can really support men to support men. And, you know, just the same as women supporting women, it's really important both ways. And I've definitely heard over the years on the mats, men opening up and speaking about the struggles of mental health. I remember once in our gym group chat, one of the guys messaged and just said he was really struggling with training at the minute. He was feeling really anxious every time he thought about coming to the gym. And I thought that was so brave for him to put that on the chat. And then so many men and women replied to him and said they feel exactly the same, and that he's not on his own, and that they were so happy that he'd brought it up. And I think the safe community that jiu-jitsu creates is what allowed that to happen. And I think with it being on the group chat as well, everybody got to see that. Everybody got to think, okay, it's not just me that feels anxious about that. And especially for men, when it can be really difficult to talk about those emotions, because, you know, somehow it makes them less masculine, less of a man. They've got to be tough all of the time. To have a space that builds that kind of camaraderie, that makes them feel that they're allowed to feel the feelings, is huge. And I suppose that's just me saying another reason that jiu-jitsu is so special.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of toxic masculinity, isn't it, really? It's why it's, oh, yeah, go on a rant about this, but yeah, it's sort of like why it's so important to sort of topple that all of that stuff, because it is as toxic for men as it is for women. And it does make jiu-jitsu very special, I guess. Is that comes down to the community and feeling safe again, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I think because jiu-jitsu has sort of quite traditional values still, even though it's a fairly new martial art, as martial arts go, it's quite modern, there still really are traditional values of respect and compassion for training partners and thinking of others, and lots of gyms still bow and shake hands and thank each other at the end of the training session. And I think all of those things are really wonderful, and they do help create that sort of safe, respectful environment. Obviously some gyms are different, but I think on the whole, a lot of gyms that I've trained at have been very much like that. You know, care for your training partner, and let's make this a safe space. Let's make everyone feel included. And, you know, being a part of that, along with being in such close proximity to people, just develops such strong bonds, I think.
Do you think that part of the strong bonds comes from the fact that there's so much physical touch?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I know there's been some research on this. There's not an awful lot of research into jiu-jitsu, like I said, but it has been sort of suggested that the physical proximity that we experience in BJJ, it can sort of replicate almost like a substitute holding environment. So it creates like a therapeutic embodiment. So it allows us to be more aware of the interactions between our mind and our body and other people's bodies, and obviously impacts the neurochemicals that are released in our brain. But the physical contact really impacts our relationship between our mind and our body, which is huge and really therapeutic, and something that you spend a lot of time in therapy trying to do is, you know, to become more aware of how your thoughts and feelings impact your body sensations. And that's one of the wonderful things that jiu-jitsu does. We're not always all aware of that, but yeah, there has been some research to sort of suggest that the close proximity to other people helps develop that, one, the mind-body connection, and two, the interactions and the friendships and the camaraderie that we experience in the gym.
Shanti, now we have an excuse as to why we prefer no-gi. Backed up with science. It's more. More. There's like towel like substances in between you.
I like the pajamas. My sister's done a little bit of jiu-jitsu and she just used to call it competitive hugging. Because she just felt like she was just like, I just get to hug people. It's lovely. And it was like, but I remember during lockdown when I'm not living with my parents and I'm going for walks with them, and not being able to hug them was physically painful. I felt really like something was seriously wrong, and I felt like I wasn't leaving like I normally left, feeling sort of, I don't know, you sort of recenter when you see, you know, really close loved ones, don't you? You sort of recalibrate. You go, oh yeah, okay, cool. I've got my security, you know, my safe space. But I was leaving them being like, I don't feel that. I wasn't getting it. And it was amazing because I was like, I didn't realize how much I relied on touch.
Yeah.
And I guess,
And for some people, training jiu-jitsu might be the only physical touch that they get in the day.
Mm-hmm.
No, not really has friends and family. Absolutely. They don't have physical contact, and so that is huge. You can see why it leads to us developing such strong bonds with people in such a short space of time as well sometimes.
It feels quite natural. Like it feels like a natural sort of, you know, when you're rolling around with someone afterwards, you are just like, we've just crossed a boundary here of like, you know, let's not be like, I don't know, light with each other. Let's get into this, you know,
Very quickly, going back to what you said about you as a coach, how do women out there, female coaches, how should they claim their space? So this might not only happen in your case, that might be a general thing. So how do women, what's your spin on it? How to go about it?
I think it's really hard. It can be so intimidating being in such a male dominated environment, and to feel like you're able to take up the space that you deserve. For me, it has been training for a long time, developing connections with people that share my values, with people that, you know, especially with my male training partners, my male coaches, who were not afraid when I felt unable to say something, for me to be able to sort of speak to them and for them to say, actually, you just spoke over, or, you know, what were you saying, Lily? You know, things like that. And now I feel confident to do that for myself. But I think it's been really helpful to make connections with people that share my values and understand what it's like to be a woman, and a small woman in such a male-dominated space where most people are double my body weight, and, you know, a lot of people still appreciate what I've got to bring to the table, but there's always some people that don't, and I think that's been huge. But I think also being in a gym that makes adjustments for people as well. So I know at Rebellion we will split up sparring, so we have sort of lighter people and heavier people. I personally, obviously, I'm really aware of all the women that train and the level that they're at, and I always make sure that they don't go unnoticed, because I felt that for a long time, you know, because I was not strong and I couldn't necessarily show everything that I knew in sparring because everyone was so much bigger than me. It felt a lot of the time I didn't really get any acknowledgement, and that's really disheartening because we all want that. And so I think, being a part of a gym that celebrates people's differences, that makes adjustments to support the women and people that struggle, people that are less confident, is huge, because it isn't just on the woman to feel confident to take up the space. It's on the people that have the privilege and the power to make those changes, to make it a safer space for people to be in. And that's why I feel grateful that now, as a coach and a higher grade in the gym, that I can make sure that that happens. Because that wasn't the case when I started training. And you're not going to feel confident as a woman in a male-dominated space when you've just started training to take up the space you deserve. Mm. You're going to need somebody to help you with that and to support you.
Definitely.
And I think that's
that
huge.
Was a really good answer. I really like that. Really like it.
Thanks.
And we have our final question that we ask all of our guests. And this can be specific or general and interpreted however you like. But what are you fighting for?
I think really a lot of what I've just sort of said in the you know, previous question, I'm fighting for women to be more accepted in jiu-jitsu, to have their voices heard, to not be questioned just because they're women. To make sure the gym that I train at is an inclusive space that makes adjustments for people that need it. And that's not just women, it's anybody that needs that extra support. For women to feel like they've got just as much right to be on the mat and sparring as the strong athletic guys. I think, yeah, to be in a gym where you can come to a class, be the only woman there and feel like it's fine and people aren't thinking, oh God, what's wrong with the woman? You know, for people to be able to sort of accept our differences and the different things that we bring to the table. And that's in life as a whole, but, you know, specifically for jiu-jitsu, I'm fighting for that inclusive, safe space. Mm-hmm. And I think that's happening where I train. So I feel very lucky about that.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Lily, for sharing all that with us. You're doing some really, really fascinating work with your psychology. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Women Who Fight podcast. And credit to Will Grant for being our songwriter and sound editor. Please subscribe and share and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at womenwhofight.co.uk and check out our website for more content.